Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor, your host. I want to say at the top of the show again that you can still donate to the campaign to raise $100,000 for the great station CIUT. And you can do so best by going to CIUT.FM and click on the donate button. And of course, if you contribute, donate $89.50 or more, you have a chance for a in the draw of a trip for two to Iceland. It's a round trip. You get to come home. And we hope you'll do so. And we're really glad of all the support we've been getting. It's been a very successful campaign, but we'd like our listeners to know that it continues till the end of December. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about a number of topics. In the latter part, we will take up some this business with the danger with Ukraine, around Ukraine and the position of the U.S. government in Western Europe and the response of Russia. And there's some other matters we'll touch on. Ethiopia. And we're going to come back to the matter of tennis and the attempt by an organization called the World, we all make this mistake, the Women's Tennis Association based in Florida, that is now backed by all the right-wing politicians of America in an attempt to undermine the Olympics. So we'll talk about that as well in the latter part of the show. There is some news on that front that I know our listeners would like to hear about and will not find this news, strangely enough, in the freest country in the world with the freest press. But now we're joined by Tony Leah. He is the chairperson of Local 222, chairperson of the Political Action Committee of Local 222, Unifor. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, Phil. It's a pleasure to be here with you virtually.
Yeah, well, the labor news in recent almost decades has been fairly uninspiring, but maybe the pandemic, maybe changes in the economy, but there are things going on, and your old home union, United Auto Workers, years ago, Unifor was part of United Auto Workers. Some real stirring has been going on, by the way, after a period of really dangerous and ugly, I guess you'd say, corruption in UAW. But now they're on a new path. Talk about these things.
There's been an incredible breakthrough, something that a lot of union activists in the UAW have campaigned for many, many years. But has finally come to fruition. And that is that the members of the UAW had a chance to vote in a referendum on whether or not they wanted to have a direct vote, a one member, one vote election for their international president and executive board members, or continue with the practice that's existed for many, many years, where those leaders were chosen at a convention by delegates, where it could be controlled by the existing leadership. And not surprisingly, they voted almost two-thirds, something like 63%, in favor of one member, one vote. And that is now going to be put in place for the elections coming up next year. So this is really an incredible breakthrough for people that want to see the rank and file members of the local become more active, take more control, have their own voice represented and recognized in the leadership of the union.
I want to ask you about what kind of outlook are we hearing from the people who led this campaign? Oh, by the way, I should say, who opposed it and who was in favor? And
The people
one person, one vote. Who did someone oppose that?
Yes, the existing leadership, but I think it's not surprising that they weren't very outspoken about wanting to keep things the way they are, where they control the show. But they did publish some material saying that, it would be bad to let the members choose their own leadership directly. They didn't put it that way. The main group that was campaigning for one member, one vote is a relatively new organization called Unite All Workers for Democracy, or UAWD. And this group actually began campaigning for one member, one vote before the U.S. feds brought corruption or racketeering charges against the UAW after a long series of officials were indicted and convicted and jailed. And that eventually led to an agreement to have federal government oversight of the UAW for 6 years. But even before that happened, UAWD was created and began campaigning for one member, one vote. And they were picking up a campaign that had been advanced for quite a long time. There were reformers in the UAW called the New Direction Movement. Jerry Tucker was one of the leaders of that. That idea was picked up again by UAWD, but this time, because of the backdrop of this outrageous corruption that came to light, I think that the members were much more animated, activated around this idea, and they campaigned, they put on a really impressive campaign. They got leaflets out to many of the locations, and they drove some really big votes by ordinary members in favor of one member, one vote. So for one example, there's half a dozen locals of the UAW that were involved in the John Deere strike just recently, a really heroic effort by workers there to defeat, some of the worst concessions that workers have been dealing with. Those workers voted strongly for one member, one vote. Local 600, which is a very historic local, the Ford Rouge complex, goes way back in the union's history. But recently it's been a strength of the administration caucus, the people, the leadership of the UAW. But even that local voted strongly for one member, one vote.
Oh, that's really quite remarkable. Where, by the way, is there a place where people can go? You, of course, have a blog, does Labor Notes cover this?
Labor Notes a correspondent named Jonah Furman has been writing tremendously interesting and insightful commentary in all of this. So Labor Notes is a good source. The UAWD has a website, uawd.org. And this story has really shaken up the labor movement in the United States and beyond. And so you'll find a lot of commentary in the Detroit newspapers, the newspapers in all of the cities where they have big UAW locals have been writing about it. The industry press as well, the automotive news and so on have all been writing about it. So everybody has really sat up and taken notice. This is really a very significant development in the history of the UAW.
Yeah. Now, they always say in these sort of campaigns, and by the way, particularly it's true of politics, it's true of labor politics, bread and butter, wages, conditions, contracts, and the quality of those contracts are what really motivate people. So what kind of things were they talking about, assuming they addressed these things, or perhaps they didn't? What was it that they said that they thought they could correct by a one person, one vote?
Those issues were central to this. And what the UAWD talked about is that there's a few things that seem to go hand in hand. One is the lack of democracy and control of the union by a handful of people at the top. But that seems to go hand in hand with the corruption that was uncovered, where leaders were helping themselves to the union funds. But also it went hand in hand with cooperation with management and this idea of basically of collaboration, that unions should be partners with the company, which has led to a really dismal record of concessions by the UAW, which at one time really led the way in improving wages and pensions and benefits for workers. But in the last 20 or 30 years has gone in the opposite direction and negotiated contracts where new workers are treated like dirt. You know, the so-called second tier workers, where their wages are half of what the full, you know, the previously hired workers are, and that they don't have pensions and they don't have the same benefits. So these kind of concessionary contracts are a big part of what the UAWD is campaigning for. And they said that having democratic elections is just the first step. It just opens the door for people who want to see a more aggressive, militant, class-conscious union leadership now has to come forward and campaign and get elected to the leadership so they can change the direction of the bargaining as well as just the, you know, the democratic process.
It's sort of a natural process, isn't it, that leaders who talk about the need to collaborate with and cooperate with because of hard economic times, whatever it is, it's a natural road to corruption because they get rewarded, I assume, for doing bad things to their own members. And for one thing, people will look the other way while they steal. Although it runs its course, I mean, didn't some people end up in jail over the corruption?
There's 12 significant leaders of the UAW who were caught in this corruption. They all pled guilty and they're all in jail right now. And that includes two former international presidents of the UAW. So right to the top, the two previous presidents of the UAW are in jail right now for this corruption.
They couldn't argue that the reason they were targeted was that they were such champions of labor and they were heroically on the picket lines. And
it kind of rings a bit hollow. Yes.
Pardon me?
It rings hollow.
It does a little hollow. Well, I assume they didn't even try that song.
They did, actually. I mean, they did try to say, you know, every time another one got caught and put on trial, they said, well, you know, yes, it's him. That was terrible, you know, but the rest of us are, you know, believe in the union. That's just, they're making us all look bad. We're really against that. And then the next one would get caught out. It was revolving door for a while.
Well, now, of course, Unifor was once part of, with UAW, by the way, the claim was when the UAW and Unifor, at that time CAW, parted company, they were going to remain closely bound with each other. I haven't seen a lot of evidence of that, actually. But do you see for Unifor, and we're speaking to Tony Leo, by the way, chairperson, Political Action Committee, Local 222 of Unifor. You think perhaps Canadian Unifor members might benefit from a one person, one vote?
I think that it's absolutely essential. We have been facing almost the identical circumstances of workers in the UAW in the US, particularly in the auto industry. Our union, which initially under Bob White said we needed to split from the UAW because we wanted to reject the concession path. But since Bob White left the leadership of the union, we have returned to that concession path, and we've got the same distasteful cooperation between top levels of the union leadership and corporations, which is not in the interests of workers. We have, in my own local, which represents workers at General Motors, as well as and quite a number of other companies, but at GM, we have a two-tier agreement. And now we have, when GM went through this, a little bit of a, I don't know if it was a con or some kind of a shell game where they closed down and opened up again and were able to open up again with almost entirely new workers, now paying people $13 an hour less than they were 2 years ago. But even with that, the retirees and the workers, even at the top scale, have suffered over the last, since 2007, for sure, in the last 15 years, have not kept up with inflation. We haven't had an increase in pensions in the auto industry in Canada since 2007. And there's been about 30% inflation over that period of time. So somebody like my friends who retired in 2007 are getting, in terms of the purchasing power of their pensions, 30% less.
It seems surprising, given that you're the leader of Unifor is rather close to the prime minister of the country. And what he's even been seen standing next to the premier of Ontario, two very powerful people, and they seem to like him and he seemed to like them. So I don't see how this could be happening.
Maybe that's why it's happening, of course. When union leaders value rubbing shoulders with politicians and hobnobbing with corporate leaders and put that ahead of fighting for their members, then I think this is the inevitable result, is that they're not fighting to get the best contracts for their members because they don't want to offend their buddies that they chum around with.
Isn't it somewhat an ideological matter? I mean, that they actually accept the economic picture presented to them. And they become the ones who say, well, we have to tell the members, you can't get that. That's just not doable because of the economy, or somebody very powerful explained that to us. I mean, for example, in the case of Jerry Dias, it's always pointed out that he was at the table with Chrystia Freeland and the others in the negotiations. I mean, that turns you into a bit of you end up having to speak for those people, right?
That's right. And it's very clear that when they defend the bargaining that they've done in the auto industry, they frame it as, you know, this is what we have to do so that the companies will keep jobs here. So they really have bought into and accepted, with not a lot of self-consciousness, the arguments and rationale of the corporations, and accepted that whatever the corporations tell them they need, well, they have to go along with that or else they won't get the jobs. Hmm. And that does, I think it is a function of the political direction they've gone in, with valuing ties with corporate-dominated parties like the Liberals or even the Conservatives. And, you know, that's just not going to lead you to fight for the interests of workers. It's a different ideological outlook, for sure. And if you'd rather put a union jacket on Paul Martin or act as a emissary for Chrystia Freeland, or you know, gaze up into the eyes of Justin Trudeau at a Unifor convention,
it's one of the most embarrassing photos that I've ever seen.
That's right.
Trudeau's ability to look as though he's doing an act of hypnotizing people. He really, I don't know if I want to stand in front of him. He has a deep gaze trick. We're speaking to Tony Lea, and he is the chairperson of the Political Action Committee, Local 222 Unifor. And we're speaking, of course, the issue here is democratization and this moving from a representative to a one person, one vote, which historically, by the way, is always considered a step forward around the world. When people talk about democracy, and democracy now is a favorite topic of the US, it says it's going to lead the democratic movement around the world. That'd be interesting for indigenous people, Black Americans, Latin Americans. On the point, another major union, the Teamsters, and they've begun to, there's been a little earthquake in the Teamsters. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The Teamsters have had one member, one vote since 1990. And again, at the time, it came about because of the federal government imposition of a monitoring system and in the wake of corruption. But it did open up the possibility for more militant leaders who were more in tune with the rank and file to get elected. And in fact, the first person elected in the in that system for the Teamsters was Ron Carey, and he was a different guy. He was more in tune with the rank and file. He reduced the wages, his own wages. He reduced the wages of the leadership of the Teamsters twice while he was president. He led a very militant strike against UPS a lot of it was around forcing UPS to make part-time drivers into full-time drivers with full benefits and wages. And he was reelected based on that very strong record and then taken out of office by the government oversight bureau that had been put in place.
The oversight bureau.
Barred from being a member of the union that he had just been elected president of. But that system has continued and allowed this year for a more progressive slate to get elected. And again, a lot of it centers around bargaining with UPS, getting rid of the two-tier system and the expansion of part-time drivers at UPS. And the person who's just been elected president says that that's what they have to do and that they have to deliver. It can't be about what they say. They have to deliver a good contract for UPS, and then that will be the basis for them winning an organizing drive at Amazon. And so that's the platform that was put forward by O'Brien, who's just been elected president of the Teamsters, with the support of a rank and file group called Teamsters for a Democratic Union, TDU.
And I assume people now we're in the internet stage, one could probably find them, huh? They yes. must have a site.
Yeah, they do. They have a very good website and a tremendous amount of material on it because they've been in operation for 30 years now and, you know, have really changed the culture within the Teamsters. And, you know, and this is probably their greatest success this year. And it is in a backdrop where workers have shown that they have more bargaining power and are more prepared to fight. And, you know, I think the pandemic has a lot to do with that.
Isn't it almost patently the case that if you say we're going to put the vote in the hands of the members, that the members are more likely to wake up and to pay attention and to participate than if they say, Barney's taking care of that, Barney and what can we do about him? Well, there's not lots you can do about him because he's a friend of so-and-so, you know. But if they say, no, you have the vote and we need your vote because this is what it's about.
I think you're absolutely right. And it means that the people that desire to play that leadership role in the union have to present to the members a platform. They have to say, if you vote for me, this is what I want to do. This is what I promise to deliver. And then they owe that to the members and they'll be judged on whether or not they deliver on their promises. So I think that just that fact means that, the interests of the members have to get taken into account in a different way than under the current system, the previous system in the UAW, or the current system in Unifor. You know, Jerry Dias, who you've mentioned, is going to retire, has announced he's retiring next year. And in fact, he said that at a meeting I was at of the Retired Workers Council. He said, you know, this is my last blah, blah, blah. I'm going to retire next year. He says, and we're having discussions already about who the replacement will be. Well, who's having discussions, Jerry? You're not having those discussions with the members.
Is the House of Lords going to meet?
I think the members would like to, you know, participate in that discussion. I really do believe that the members of Unifor will perk up the ears a bit when they learn about what's happening in the UAW, because that's a far better system.
But has Unifor commented on the decision of UAW to have one person, one vote?
No.
Have they expressed an opinion on the subject?
No.
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 So this is one.
We'll talk about that.
This is so their motto is shush.
Shush.
Shush. We're not, because the leaders are talking about who the next leader is going to be.
That's right. Yeah.
That's a humbling process if you're a member. This is very dramatic stuff. By the way, we shouldn't leave out, because, you know, inevitably there's stars in these things. The name Hoffa, the man who lost out, in my understanding, was Hoffa the Little, right? James Hoffa's son.
Hoffa Jr. actually just retired. He did not run again.
He didn't.
But the people in his political organization or slate within the Teamsters were defeated.
Hoffa group was defeated. It's important because Hoffa is a very, if you want to study modern American labor history, and also Canadian as well, with Teamsters, Jimmy Hoffa is a very important, one of those stories. It's like talking about Walter Reuther. You have to look at him very closely and see who they were and what they did and how they reacted. And anyway, I'm glad you clarified that the Hoffa group was defeated.
Yes. Although they splintered somewhat. And so the candidate for president had actually been part of the Hoffa group, but that he came over and ran on a slate called Teamsters United, along with the Teamsters for a Democratic Union. His name is Sean O'Brien. Mm-hmm. You know, so those things have to, you know, you have to wait and watch and see how that plays out. But he clearly, in what he was saying, was articulating what is really needed in the labor movement today. So hopefully and he'll be judged on whether or not he delivers on that. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. This is a good story to follow, the democratization and how it will impact the fight for wages and pensions and safety and all those things. It's to me a very, very hopeful sign. And I hope it goes throughout the labor movement. You mentioned they have a shush position in Unifor, but every union ought to talk about this and the respect for members, which one person, one vote would reflect. We're speaking with Tony Lea. He is the political action chairperson, political action committee, local 222 of Unifor. And Tony, there's been a pretty interesting development here in the city. Toronto, the TTC union chief, I'm reading headline, TTC union chief loses re-election bid, and Marvin Alfred becomes new president of Local 113. Behind this story is another story, which was that the TTC under the previous leader had been identified as one of the places where they were getting resistance to the idea of vaccination against COVID. And of course, we're now in a new the Omicron, I call it, and Cron. And this, there had been, the incidents had become kind of, it took on another, a life, you might say. And other people around the world were commenting, oh, there are people, the labor movement that is against the vaccine for fighting COVID. And but this vote doesn't say that, does it?
No, not at all. And it was a pretty decisive vote as well. The former president got 9% of the vote.
That one who was publicly engaging and getting in the media as
he actually was rather irresponsible, because he advised his members at one point to refuse to tell the employer what their vaccination status was. So he went beyond, you know, trying to defend the rights of members against being disciplined or fired, but actually advising them not to comply with stating their vaccination status. That kind of irresponsibility, I think, played into the lack of support from members at the election.
I would think so, because he had made that the issue, right? I mean, if anytime anybody heard of his name, it was because he was in the media or at public events, behaving, loudly and demonstratively in favor of his point of view. And you say he got 9% of the vote.
Well, that's what the media has reported. I don't have any inside information, but yeah.
Well, could it have been 11%?
No, I think it was probably 9. I did see that the union, has published some information since then, talking about the new president, and I think it's probably a good sign. The Star article says that it's probably the first Black member elected as president of that local. So I think there's a number of factors there that
very positive.
Would lead us to be, pleased with the developments there.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I raise it, frankly, is that I've been disappointed that Max Blumenthal of Gray Zone, made an error which he's not ordinarily doesn't make, which is respect for facts. He almost a month ago now was looking. I don't know what category to put him in, but he was looking for signs. And unfortunately, when you look for something, you might see things that are your desire for something to be true may turn out not to be true. He tweeted a story from Australia, and you and I spoke about it on the Taylor Report, I think it was transit workers in one city in Australia were allegedly protesting against the vaccine policy of the Australian government. However, he was answered by Australian trade unions and by members of the very union that he was talking about. And they said, you're mistaken. It is not true. Our union does not have a position opposing vaccinations. And we're urging people, and instead we urge to people to follow the policy to prevent the spread of COVID. So now here's a story, almost a parallel story. And since he was telling that, Blumenthal was, he was looking for places where he could show labor was somehow, the rank and file wanted to oppose vaccine. I guess I can use the word mandates, but particularly in public service. But the trend is going the other direction, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think that, from what I've seen, most union members, most union leadership are very supportive of the need for vaccination and other measures. And it's mainly been corporations that have been willing to sacrifice the health and safety of their workers for their own interests. So yes. If we remember back to the early days of the pandemic.
Meatpacking plants out west, right? Where the people working under plants. Horrible conditions.
Yep. But they had to keep working because, you know, you can't shut them down. That'll interfere with the economy. And by the economy, they mean the right of corporations to maximize their profits. But closer to home as well, the Amazon warehouse in Brampton had something like 600 COVID cases. Because they also face those working conditions where they're, you know, under pressure all the time and working in close quarters. And, the company doesn't want to implement any kind of health and safety measures because it might slow people down. And so they just have to, you know, put up with a certain number of them getting sick or dying or whatever. So it's the corporations that really have resisted protecting workers. It's not unions that have done that.
And on an international scale, we have the corporate class that runs us all, the plutocrats, that are not sharing the vaccine unless they're paid up front. And they put you on a list of when they might provide it. But Africa, particularly South Africa now, has real difficulties. And I don't see the hue and cry from those who, like Blumenthal, caused this, making, I think, serious mistake, saying vaccinate everybody on the planet against the COVID and then you can defeat it.
It's certainly a feature of capitalism to try to control everything for profit. And so the even though vaccines were developed in most cases with billions of dollars of public money.
And by the way, with a promise it's going to be for the public.
For the public, supposedly. But guess what? It's corporations who now own, the patent on those vaccines and are not willing to share them, or not willing to let other countries produce the vaccine. They're not willing to give them the formula because they want to sell it. And millions of people are dying, so that they can keep, protect their proprietary rights to those vaccine. It's so distasteful. It's so horrible.
Brings up the thought of Joe Hill's song, "You'll Get Pie in the Sky By and By."
Oh, yeah. When you die.
Tony Leah, thank you very much. Political Action Chairperson, Local 222. And we really appreciate it. A lot of information. We're sort of in favor of democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil.
This is Taylor Report, CIT. And we will be back with some more, actually, on the matter of COVID and the appropriate response of some governments and the inappropriate response of others. See you then.